Donald, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
I thought we'd start. It's going to be a broad-ranging conversation about business intelligence, pre-machine learning era, and then where we're headed with language models. When you were launching Power BI, I'd love for you to just set the stage for us. What was the field of business intelligence like, even pre sort of machine learning in the predictive analytics era, when you were launching, the seminal Power BI product?
You know, it was, the evolution had been pretty long. It was this fairly long evolution to get to where we were with products like Power Pivot, Power BI. It had come out of data warehousing, which itself had come out of the concept of management information systems, which themselves had come out of the concept of decision support systems. So we'd had this growing sort of sense and technical kind of development of how do you centralize, very much it was all about centralization, how do you centralize the data in an organization so that it can be analyzed? And we added business intelligence on top of that. That was a term that was, again, introduced by Howard of Gartner. That was sort of pretty interesting, Howard Dresner. And then people started to say, well, reports aren't good enough, so we need these interactive dashboards. From that point, as the tools became easier, we then had self-service. And so at this particular point, around 2005, 2008, you had the development of real self-service tools, which enabled business users to essentially do their own work. The phrase that was used was with or without IT's permission. And that that was happening. Now, that had, to a certain extent, always happened in Excel. Now it was happening in bespoke tools for doing this kind of analysis. Predictive analytics was something which had been a specialization. You had predictive analytics in the kind of world of SAS, which was used primarily by scientists, data scientists, and statisticians. You had SPSS, which had been acquired by IBM, which was focused, it actually was statistical package for social sciences, SPSS, so it was used a lot by social scientists and historians and people like that. So that was a specialized area. And there was just this sense that there was now enough power. There was enough power on a desktop, especially because of 64-bit computing. There was enough memory. There was enough storage. You could actually start to do some of this work yourself. And the really compelling question was, what does that mean to do this work yourself? What are you actually going to do? Are you going to build dashboards that you're going to share with everyone? Are you going to replace the IT function of creating the corporate system of record? Or is it more for sort of personal exploration and analysis? And I think the latter was really the compelling story at the time. We didn't want to replace IT. That wasn't the purpose. It was to enable sort of personal exploration and analysis with better quality and more insight than you have before. So that's kind of where we were at that point.
And as far as our listeners are concerned, I think the interesting part of your talk on evolution and how we have been moving through these different deltas in decision making and business intelligence, ranging from just getting the data centralized in warehouses, and then wow, once it's centralized, what can we do with that information? There's always a through line, which is the goal of many goals was generally to put the data in front of key decision makers to provide enough, ample context in order to make decisions. Is that fair? Is that basically always
been the goal? Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, so I said we're talking about business intelligence, predictive analytics, which came out of data warehousing, which came out of management information systems, which came out of decision support systems. And it turns out that decision support is still what we're doing. All these years later, we're still trying to help business people make better decisions. I actually prefer the term decision support because it at least tells you what the software does. It supports you in making decisions. Who knows what business intelligence means? Sort of vague term. So I'm sort of interested in that.
That's a good distinction because I think as our conversation goes on, I think we will start to make that distinction a little clearer because I agree in the sense that business intelligence, just as a term, can mean what you want it to mean, right? Is is this where the intelligence of the business lives? Is the platform itself the intelligence, or is it providing me with data to make me intelligent? So the idea of decision support, I think, is much more concise, providing that context to make decisions. So on that note, what are the kinds of decisions that people are trying to make with these business intelligence tools? Like, what goes into making these decisions, and how is the machine learning and AI supporting that?
It's, of course, the range of decisions that are made is absolutely huge. But you can think of it, you can structure the thinking about decisions in three categories, broad categories. There are strategic decisions, which are, you know, which new industry are we going to enter if you're a conglomerate? Which new market are we going to open? Are we going to move into, you know, the Asian market? Or what offices are we going to close? What stores are we going to open? Big questions. And you can think of them as having each individual question has very, very high business value. Relatively speaking, there's very few of them. And those are strategic decisions. The very opposite end of the scale, there are decisions where they have relatively small business value. What discount do I offer this customer? Who do I call next? What do I do about this alarm? Each one has relatively small business value in the big scheme of things. But of course, there are millions of those decisions in a typical business. So that's the very opposite end. Those are operational decisions. So relatively low value, but a large number. There's a kind of process of aggregation as you move from operational to strategic. Data is aggregated. Decisions become made at higher levels in the organization. And there are typically more data sources involved. So data becomes more diverse. And right in the middle between the operational and the strategic, you have this kind of tactical decision-making, the decisions of middle managers who are taking all the operational information, aggregating it up, and making decisions for the medium term. And those decisions themselves may then feed into strategic decisions in the future. So where is business intelligence working? Business intelligence primarily historically has worked with the tactical decision-making of the middle managers. Increasingly, we're seeing business intelligence being pushed down into operational decisions through embedded analytics, for example. And I think with the advent of AI, we're starting to see some of the potentially strategic decision-making being informed by analytics rather than driven by analytics, but at least being informed by it. But the sweet spot is still this center of tactical decision-making.
Donald, I remember a distinct moment pre-COVID. We were discussing the state of BI, and you ended up saying, you know, the pace of innovation was just slowing. You had said a lot of existing the same stuff again and again in terms of different, you know, same ETL tooling or same visualization. A lot of these categories were just mature. You know, the growth rates were slowing. A lot of products were differentiating on a feature by feature basis. And then we had LLMs. And so maybe you could talk a little bit, just at a high level, what new energy and principles language models have created in this market that, you know, towards the end of the decade was actually thought of to be fairly mature, both by practitioners and investors alike.
Yeah, I think I was right before COVID. I mean, the market was kind of slowing down precisely because there were no new scenarios opening up. And it's new scenarios opening up, which then drives technological development, or equally technological development can open up new scenarios. And that just wasn't happening. And in particular, we hadn't solved this problem of how to get into strategic decision-making. We absolutely knew how to push analytics and even to a certain extent automation down into operational decision-making, but not into the high business value area of strategic decision-making. And one of the reasons for that is because that decision-making is actually, when you think about it, it's all about language. We often talk about, you know, businesses being driven by data and so on, but we've all seen those business meetings where there's a slide on screen, there's some data, but 90% of what is discussed is not on screen. It's not in the slide. It's not in the data. It's the conversation that happens around the table. Well, here's a business trend, but now let's have an hour's discussion about what that trend means. That's language. That's what drives the higher level decisions. So what's really interesting about LLMs is they actually provide a way of providing a data-driven input to that language. And they become either assistants, or they become advisors, or they're able to find patterns and put them in language terms. And what this means then is that they can become, if you like, part of that conversation. And I think that's really... Sorry.
No, please.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's a really interesting phase that we're getting at, is where the LLM enables the analytic process to become a team member of the decision-making organization. That's a sort of slightly fanciful way of describing it, but I actually think that is the fundamental shift that we see.
So would you say then that the percolation of data-driven or decision support moving from the middle layer, the technical layer, to strategic, would you say that it was more that the LLM technology had empowered movement towards strategic decision-making? Or would you say it was more on the side of more people were trying to make strategic decisions in that time period, and LLMs just kind of happened to be around and people latched onto it? Or would you say it was a little bit of a two-way synchronous there?
Well, I think that's a great point. LLMs really came about at a very convenient time, at a point that was already pivotal in the history of business, I think, and in history of business decision-making, which is that we came out of this dramatic crisis. And of course, there had been during COVID a lot of changes of strategy, most of which was thinking on our feet. You know, that really was an emergency. Coming out of the emergency, there was this need for a completely new strategic view of the world that had to happen. And then along comes this new tool at exactly the time when we need to take the strategic view of the world. Now, to be fair, the tool is still somewhat behind. The LLMs are still somewhat behind the strategic need. But you can see this happening. You can see this trend already, that every analytics company, every analytics tool set is integrating LLMs as a way of providing higher level insight and deeper insight, precisely because people have to make those decisions. And I think you're right, there are more of these decisions that have to be made just now, partly as we adapt to the world post-COVID. And of course, as we adapt to the world of LLMs, we also have to now make decisions. So it becomes a sort of virtuous cycle, I think, that's driving the very rapid developments that we're seeing just now.
Any examples, Donald, specific use cases of a strategic higher level insight in terms of demos, et cetera, or lines of business you're seeing transformed by this newer wave of BI that have really given you pause or gotten you excited?
Lines of business are, which are super affected by this, I think, are going to be areas like supply chain management, which is an enormously complex field. And trying to understand, my favorite example of this was, the ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal, which was blocking the Suez Canal, the world's most important shipping lane.
That was a fun week, I think, all around.
And
for everyone watching, that was an interesting and fun week to learn about supply chain management.
it really was. And you suddenly discovered overnight how extremely fragile the world's supply chains were. Actually, you kind of realized how robust they had been before and how fragile they were now, that this just-on-time process was actually, in many ways, kind of miraculous that it worked and it achieved so much, but it was fragile. And one of the problems with supply chain analysis, it's so immensely complex. There are so many variables within that. And as your margins come down and down, knowledge of those variables, being able to manage those variables, becomes more and more important. We won't go back to a system where we just oversupply, overstock in order to manage this. We're still going to be doing just-in-time supply chain management. We just need to do it with more and more smarts. And I think it's been fascinating to see. Artificial intelligence playing its role in supply chain management. So that's a whole area, as a line of business, it's a whole area of business which I think is being affected. And then there are some other areas. I think we're all kind of familiar already with it being used in areas like marketing, which seems like a very obvious sort of field for it, especially if we're talking about LLMs, because LLM are language. I think we see it in fields like HR as well, where we're dealing with human beings. That's important. But I do think when it comes down to the business functions that are going to be most affected, I think you're going to see the business function primarily of supply chain management. And in our world, you know, the kind of tech world, we're going to see coding and development greatly affected by LLMs.
So long-time listeners of the show know, probably might guess what I'm going to say next, because I'm on record saying this a lot. But what a lot of what you're saying kind of gives credence to the idea that LLMs are, at least at their core, and how people, when they think about how to use an LLM, they are phenomenal reasoning agents. They are reasoning machines more than they are thinking machines, right? LLMs have shown that they can encode knowledge and recall knowledge, you know, when asked. That's not really up to them. They can do that. However, where they truly shine, where they truly provide the most value, seems to be when you do this warehousing, you centralize this data, you aggregate this data, and then you, to kind of use your analogy a little bit here, just in time, provide this context to the LLM with a surrounding context, a question, let's say, a business intelligence question, and say, what do you think we should be doing? That AI in the room, that analogy that you were giving earlier, is that true? Is that how you think about LLMs acting here? Is that
I don't think of them that way. I don't think of them as either reasoning or thinking. I think of them as remixing. They are remixing what the information that they have, and that is what they're brilliant at doing. They're fantastically good at remixing. I think you can actually see that they, in a sense that they can't reason, or they have to be told how to reason. And they can be told how to reason by human beings who know how to reason and can walk them through the steps, and then they can do it. The example I always want to give here, just kind of off the wall a little bit, is do you remember the chimpanzees that could learn to speak? They could do sign language and things like that. There was Washoe and things like that. And it was always amazing to see them. And there was a parrot that knew 100 words or whatever. And yet, when you look at those animals doing that, 99% of the effort, the energy, the insight, and the intelligence that went into that conversation was on the human side. You know, none of these chimpanzees ever woke up saying, hey, I want to speak to a human being. I wonder if I can do it this way. It was all the human being doing that effort. When you see LLMs doing amazing things, mostly behind that, there is a human being who has put the effort in to make the LLM do it, and then it's able to do it. And we get so amazed by the LLM doing it that we forget that there's a huge amount of human effort and intelligence and structure went into that. So when you see LLMs doing mathematics, solving mathematical theorems, coming up with new theorems, which I think is amazing, but there's a human being who has given that structure so that the LLM can then remix the knowledge it's been given in this fascinating way. And so I think of them always as remixing engines rather than having their own reasoning. And my favorite example to show this to you, or for you to try yourself, I think actually I've seen me doing this, is ask it to do something like, give me a 9-letter synonym of the word happy, or 7-letter synonyms of the word happy. And any of the common engines, they'll give you some, but they'll also give you a whole pile of its synonyms which don't have 7 letters. They have 5, they have 6, they have 9. And then you can reason with it and say, well, why, you know, you've got 9 here, there's 7 here, 5 there, why is that happening? And the LLM will very helpfully respond, you know, oh, my mistake, I'll try again, and then does this exactly the same thing again. Comes out with a different list with you know, more mistakes, and then you go back in, you know, give me a list of synonyms, and for every synonym, count the letters, and then only output the ones which have 7 letters. Still can't do it. But the reason it can't do that is because certain synonyms, like content, would be so strong that it just can't do that. You know, delighted is such a strong synonym for happy that weighting in the system completely overweights the rule. Don't output anything that doesn't have 7 letters. And that's why it's not particularly reasoning, it's remixing. And I think if you think of it as a remixing technology, It gives you more insight, or it gives you, I think, a more useful insight rather than thinking of it as a reasoning technology.
I like that word. I like that word a lot, Donald, remixing, because even when I do my own kind of lectures on the topic and I say, you know, reasoning over thinking, obviously at a very high level, my immediate next slide is, now let's watch me ask it how many syllables are in the phrase Golden Gate Bridge. And let's watch it get it fantastically wrong.
Right.
And I'll do a lot of examples like that. Like I'll say, here's a relatively simple math problem, you know, X times, you know, 140 times 78 plus the remainder of 22 divided by 21. And I was like, don't write code, don't reason through it, just tell me the answer. And then it'll give me the answer wrong, but pretty close. And then I say, actually think about it step by step, and then it will get it right. It's like, oh my.
And you've done that effort. You've put
But
that
I'm the one in. Who did the effort to say, I'm telling you how to solve this problem. So the act of reasoning, and I think, you know, to remix what I was saying earlier, a lot of that just-in-time context is not just data from a warehouse, but it's also the steps in which the human wants to take in order to make that decision.
I think that
remixing makes a lot of sense.
And there's another part of this that people worry a lot about hallucinations. And hallucinations from AI, of course, typically mean things that don't exist or things which are just totally out of there, totally, totally wrong. And you see, of course, pictures of people holding coffee cups and they've got seven fingers or whatever. And then we're told that these are hallucinations from the AI. I think it's important to remember that in a sense, everything that AI produces is a hallucination. If AI produces a picture of somebody holding a coffee cup with five fingers, or four fingers and a thumb, the process of doing that is exactly the same as a process of doing seven fingers and two thumbs. It's just it happened to get it right. There's nothing substantially different when it produces a hallucination. It's just that it hasn't had enough examples to produce a real one. So there's no difference in the process. Now, when a human being hallucinates, there's something wrong. There's something wrong in your neurology or in your senses. So there's actually something different when a human being hallucinates as opposed to human being perceiving in a normal way. There's something different going on when an AI hallucinates as opposed to getting it right. It's just that the information that is remixing is different. Either it doesn't have enough or it has too many sources or but there's nothing necessarily going wrong. And I think that's actually important to understand that in a sense, the AI is getting it wrong, but it's getting it wrong by exactly the same process as it got it right. So when it gets it right, that is just as random, if you like, as getting it wrong.
Yeah. I wanted to use that in the context of the Suez Canal example, Donald, because I like it as a example of decision making, because we take that crisis, there's everything, there's a lot of downstream implications, there's the strategic to mid-level to tactical insight, and we use that example. I really like this analogy of LLMs as just in time context for every decision making at every level. And so if we take that example, I could imagine, you know, a lot of just information being aggregated at your fingertips. So you think about the whole data prep layer, right? Of essentially a lot of slide making, a lot of Excel reporting, a lot of dashboarding.
Please, we call them vector databases now, Akshay.
a lot of preparation essentially being completely transformed and a whole swath of the BI, you know, tooling ecosystem being changed as a result of this. Are there any, which parts of the tool chains are the big winners in this new LLM world, and which parts are going to have to rethink their business? If you think about a lot of the like legacy or existing BI players, I'm curious that just-in-time context actually had pretty radical implications for their customers. So would love to get your perspective on that.
I think the people who really suffer here are the architectures that require data to be extracted and loaded, and these processes, ETL, that I spent so long in my career building. But the idea that I'm going to extract data, transform it into a particular kind of model, and then load it, and then I'm just going to run a set of decisions from that because I got the model right in the first place, and now I build a data warehouse, which is going to last for 10 years, and it's going to be, you know, I'm going to make decisions off it. That model is completely broken now. It always was, to a certain extent, broken, because it was never really possible to predict in advance all the questions that might be asked in a system. And, you know, when we think about data quality that you mentioned, you know, there's no real measure of data quality. The only measure of data quality is it fit for purpose? And if the first purpose changes, then the data is no longer fit for that purpose or for the new purpose. And therefore, the quality, which was good last week, is now no longer good. And so anyone who's building architectures that are based on that principle, that you can define in advance what it is you want to do, therefore you can build the appropriate model and it's going to have some kind of lifetime because the process of building it is so long that it has to have a lifetime to make it worthwhile doing, I think they're in real trouble. So I think traditional ETL, I think traditional warehouse models are in real trouble.
Are they in trouble in the sense that they need to, like, I guess, is it as simple as, at a high level, that these traditional ETL pipelines need to now incorporate new methodologies for aggregation, specifically for LLMs or some other kind of AI process? Or is it in the sense that the fundamental techniques and tooling behind ETL, it's just there's no way to fix it. We have to start over from scratch. I guess, where are we on that spectrum of how to fix that problem?
They do need to adapt to some of the new demands. In other words, they need to know how to load vector databases. That seems like a fairly obvious thing. There are some things like that they must be able to do. But when I say they're in trouble, what I really mean is just that they will not be the center of attention anymore. I mean, it'll still exist. We still have reporting systems. There's still a lot of people out there running on mainframes, after all. So there are, you know, it's not as if these technologies disappear. They're no longer the center of attention, the business and the energy and the investment and so goes somewhere else. So I don't think they necessarily disappear. Probably still have these models hanging around, but they do need to adapt. They do need to be able to. One of the things that is sort of interesting with LLMs, of course, and LLMs in particular, generative AI in particular, is I think one of the biggest problems I had when I was building ETL tools and when I was building predictive analytic tools was just testing, finding data sets that were rich and complex enough in order to test all the different kind of variables. That was just a huge effort. It's difficult to describe how much effort we went in to building data sets that were capable of exercising these tools to their limits. Nowadays, I did a demo the other day for a client of mine, and we were talking about recommendation engines, and I just spun up a data set, you know, of medical equipment recommendation engines, and so I just went to an LLM and said, give me 2,000 rows of data that I can use to build this recommendation engine, and there it was, and it had patterns, and it had interesting patterns, and it had outliers, and it was a cool demo in about, you know, 20 minutes. That's cool.
We're talking about data prep. We're talking about ETL. Donald, I have to get your, I feel like a week does not pass where I don't get a new text-to-SQL company. so I have to ask, is it the new self-serve BI where it means both everything and nothing simultaneously? What is your take on those sorts of plays and how that category will play out? Because it can be that the challenges around data prep, but there are some issues with it.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, the thing is with a text-to-SQL company at some point is that at what point does the LLM just become capable of doing that anyway? Just generic LLMs. You know, it's not just text-to-SQL. I mean, I don't know about you, but I really struggle to remember all my Git commands, you know. So I rarely write a Git command now without, you know, ChatGPT helping me. DAX, you know. Oh, my goodness.
I'm still not 100% sure what rebasing is, but I still do it sometimes.
There you go. It's like remixing. And so, you know, at some point, just the generic LLMs will be perfectly capable of generating pretty good SQL. In fact, they are pretty good SQL. So, you know, it just becomes commoditized. That doesn't mean that there's not a sort of interesting use case, because one of the things that they've actually, I think part of what they've tapped into with these numerous text SQL engines is, first of all, that actually there is a big gap between the concept of what I want to achieve and the code I write in order to achieve it. And there are a lot of people, it tells you that a lot of people who want to get value out of systems are not the people that the systems are built for. So we have this little bridge just now, which is text to SQL. It just goes away eventually because it either becomes part of the generic capability of LLMs or that gap gets bridged in another way. The system does become capable of being used by the user. So, I think it's fascinating, but I don't think it's a long-term capability. On the other hand, you know, it's a useful utility in the short term.
It's a very similar thinking to how a lot of people think about prompt engineering, myself included, is, again, in a lot of my, I'm on record saying things like prompt engineering is a bridge in a lot of ways, especially early prompt engineering and really scaffolding your prompts and asking things in the right order, taking advantage of the auto-aggressiveness of the LLM. A lot of that has dissipated in the sense that the LLMs got more capable, they got more data from us and their users, and it became less required to really force the LLM to, let's say, provide a JSON output. Now it will happily do that with misspellings in your prompt even. It knows what you're trying to do. So that kind of idea of a bridge to me makes complete sense, right? The idea that it was genuinely difficult, having had clients ask to do text to SQL a year or two ago, even 2 years ago, it was relatively difficult to actually get it to be consistent and more deterministic and actually create that pattern. Nowadays, you don't really need a consultant like me to get that up and running, not as much at least. So that bridge analogy, I think, is quite perfect. I do want to come back to, you made it a point to say the traditional ETL is no longer the most important, the focus is not there anymore. So let's actually come back to where the focus is and the idea of having that remixing agent in the room and talking about, well, there's a slide on the screen and there's voices in the room. How should people be thinking about AI, either decision-making or decision support? Should AI in the room be more of a passive voice, like we will respond to it, or what situations should and can we let AIs take more of the reins and what kinds of, what goes into that?
I think there's a technical and a sociological element to that. I think the sociological element is kind of interesting. You know, if you give an AI a decision to make, what are the consequences to the AI of getting it wrong? Probably none. The person who gave the AI the decision is probably the one who's going to suffer consequences if a wrong decision is made. And I don't think that's a flippant point. I think, you know, if you're going to your decision making in an organization, which is also a matter of confidence and is also a matter of the ethos of the organization, we have to think about, you know, what it means to run in an organization where an AI is making decisions. So that's a sort of, I think there's a whole sociological element, which I think is going to be fascinating. And we're going to see the sociology of business probably change quite a lot as a result of this. On the technical side, what does it mean to give an AI a decision? I think the really interesting question is what can be done with the decision? Who executes the decision? And there's a difference, for example, between an AI doing automation on a production line where the AI decides to speed up and the AI is controlling the production line and it tells a motor to go faster and the production line goes faster, as opposed to an AI making a decision and then sending out instructions to a human being who's then going to go and execute a sales plan or something. You know, so there's an AI where the decision making is sort of self-contained and there's AI as an input to human decisions. And, you know, will we be, that's a different process. And I think, and it also comes down to this operational, tactical, and strategic decision-making. AI definitely can be an input to strategic decision-making made by human beings. It can execute itself and operational decisions and automation, which is super exciting. And we're seeing a lot of that. The area in the middle, the tactical, I think we're, is, for example, AI ever going to automatically decide to reroute ships because there's blockage in the Suez Canal? I think we're getting close to that. I think we're getting close to AI being able to make some of those tactical decisions. And we're already seeing, for example, and it's not a great example because there's been some trouble in this space, of course, but with trucking and shipping and transshipping, we're starting to see, you know, AI automatically setting routes for trucks and so on. And obviously Convoy had their problems with that, but actually there's a whole lot of other issues there that have got nothing to do with the AI kind of components of it. But we're getting smarter and smarter about AI being able to inform and even execute on some of these tactical decisions.
So those kind of more tactical, those operational decisions, this is maybe a little bit off the wall question, but speaking of chains, when crypto became extremely popular, the number one answer to the question, where is blockchain technology going to be useful outside of NFTs, fungible coins? The answer 100% of the time was supply chain management. What is up with supply chain management? Is it just because it's, well, here's my thinking. A lot of our conversation has been around when the need arised and LLM for strategic thinking after post-COVID and LLMs were there, it was a pretty easy grasp to say, this is going to help us. I see a parallel in blockchain technology where if, you know, supply chain management as an industry was looking for some more technologies, blockchains happened to be there, and then there was some connection made. I guess my question to you then is, when these emerging technologies come up and then people are pretty quick to say, oh, that's where LLMs can fit. Oh, this is where blockchains can fit. And kind of coming back to your idea of a chain of command, so to speak, and you know the AI can make a decision, but then route instructions to a human. What are some of the cautionary pieces of advice that you would want to give someone who is genuinely thinking about putting an AI in the room and giving it as much reins as possible, whether an operational, kind of the middle, a tactical or strategic?
Well, I think the caveat to all this has to be the complexity of human needs and desires, you know, which is really interesting to me. And when we tie it into supply chain, you know, what are people actually trying to want and what are they actually trying to achieve? And one of the odd things about optimization is that when you optimize something and make it more readily available, it immediately becomes less attractive. People want what's less available. So in a sense, optimization of these processes is going to be very commoditization, if you like. So I'd always say, what was the biggest question that you could ask? What was the question that everybody asked at the beginning of the COVID crisis? What was the number one thing on every person's mind at the height of the COVID crisis? Yes, the question that on everybody's mind was, where do I buy toilet paper? That became the critical question in the world. Where do I get toilet paper? I was in Rwanda at the time that the COVID crisis broke, and at the market they were joking that I should be taking rolls of toilet paper home as souvenirs because you couldn't buy it in Seattle. They'd seen all this on television. But what's interesting about that is something that was completely commodity suddenly became really, really important. But equally, toilet paper wasn't important to us when it was a commodity. And the reason I make this point is because ultimately business and economies are about providing people what they want with the right value. And the interesting thing about AI is that the more it automates something, it actually changes that value. And does AI understand the dynamics of that? And that starts to get really interesting. So, you know, the way AI, for example, has changed. If you look at the work that people like Uber and Lyft did, if you look at what has happened with food delivery, that hasn't changed taxis and it hasn't just changed food delivery services to restaurants. It's actually changed the entire structure of the way people live in cities. And I think that would be, those consequences are not necessarily visible to an AI. And so I think the number one caveat I would give to people about any of these technologies is who understands and who is going to own the human consequences of what happens. And that's true both of a small decision, operational decision, which is why I was saying if you give AI a decision to make, what happens to the AI if it gets it wrong? What are the consequences for it? There are none, but there are human consequences. And you've got to have that in the loop, because the AI is completely incapable of understanding those human consequences or responding to them or taking them into account.
I think that is a a wonderful message to end on, Donald. Thank you so much for being on the show and in giving all of us an understanding of what goes into decision-making, the types of decisions, and what are the, again, the consequences and feedback loops of those decision processes. So, Donald, thanks so much for being on. We really appreciate it.
That's a great pleasure. Thank you. Really enjoyed it.